risk running into a gathering recession morphing into a depression. I'm concerned that the response by the policymakers and those in charge won't only be beneficial in terms of arresting the rate of virus infections. In other words, I think their cure might be worse than the disease. And I don't want to make light of any deaths. Don't get me wrong. I want to repeat that. But as such, the world economic, financial, and political order, I think, could come apart at the seams if we morph into a full-fledged depression. People at the Fed are talking about 30% unemployment.
Hello, everyone, and welcome into CrushTheStreet.com. Dr. Anthony Fauci, you know, in a recent press conference, is now estimating 100 to 200,000 deaths here in the U.S. over the next couple of weeks. I mean, pretty staggering numbers. Is that high? Is it low? You know, what is the real impact? Are we overreacting to this virus, underreacting? And that's doing everything with the social distancing practices. These estimates are with that. The world is coming to an economic grind. We're under essentially a totalitarian control with our freedom stripped from us in efforts to contain this virus. The economic damage that is taking place cannot be fully understood at this time because the crisis continues to get dragged on. And maybe some of these estimates are optimistic or too optimistic. So we're going to flush through a lot of this with our next guest today. His name is Dan Kurz of DK Analytics. He's on the line. He's a returning guest. He does YouTube videos. He posts. And he's a great commentator on the economy. He's talked a lot about the bubble, what was leading up to this crisis prior to it happening. So a lot of this is it was expected in a certain way. I think the bazooka of the coronavirus exploding this bubble was unexpected, but the bubble popping wasn't. So we're going to talk about that today. Without any further ado, Dan, thanks for coming on Crush the Street with me today.
Thanks a lot for having me, Kenneth.
Dan, I'm aware of six people in my life that have COVID-19 tested positive for it. Now, I have a unique sample in my own indirect life, which I'm aware of. People I've shaken hands with, I know. Five of these people have been hospitalized. Now, one of them has actually died. Another one is a 28-year-old man who is otherwise healthy, no underlying health conditions. He's fighting for his life right now on a ventilator. You know, I want to just ask you about this. Now, is it possible that I'm aware of these things because we're now hyper aware of COVID-19? Is this being dramatized to a certain degree? And that's why, you know, all of these statistics are flaring up and everyone's going, oh my God, you know, look at what's happening. Or is this just, you know, something like similar to the flu, you know, would you say? And obviously my stats can't be applied on a global scale. I mean, I have six people in my life, but it's just an odd thing that I'm knowing people that are being affected by this in a very serious way.
Yeah, first of all, my heart goes out to the people that you know that have been hit by this and the person that most unfortunately and tragically died.
Thank you.
These are horrific things. And, you know, there's a saying, when your neighbor loses his job, it's a recession. And when you lose yours, it's a depression. And statistics, if this hits you and it affects you personally, and any of us might have this misfortune. And as the disease spreads and takes its toll, obviously we're going to have bigger numbers. So this isn't to be taken lightly. At the same time, I think there's some tension that needs to be placed upon what are the larger potential infection rates and the potential mortality rates. Now, let me be clear, I'm a layman. I have very limited scientific knowledge, so my remarks here are going to be commensurately short. From what I have read from people at Yale, people at Stanford, two professors from Germany, their conclusion is a bit different than the headlines. That is that if you took a population set and we're getting more tests that included all the people that now also have antibodies or have been affected, and you bring them on board, instead of just taking more people that do succumb to this, despite the exceptions which you mentioned, tend to have weaker immune systems, tend to be older. They also tend to get taken out more by other flus or influenzas that we have. My bigger point is, it is possible that this virus isn't too dramatically different at the end of the day, despite all this huge damage, than other influenzas are in terms of the mortality rate in a broader population set. Now, again, you know, we sit here and we wonder, this has been hyper-analyzed. The flu on average takes out 40,000 people in the United States. 600,000 people sadly die of cancer every year. About 800,000 people die of cardiac arrest related symptoms. Here the bigger question, I guess, is, well, good, Dan, so what? This thing spreads like the devil and you can't really contain it. So the real danger is, if it does spread and it's hard to stop this, to what degree is the spread of this disease helping in effect to naturally immunize those people with strong immune systems, meaning that they then have the antibodies to put it down and help contain it? And clearly all the precautions that the CDC puts out and common sense and all these things, and wash your hands thoroughly, these are all apt. But I, in a related sense, and I've posted on this and also did a video, I wonder if in a global sense, the cure, that is shutting down the world's economy, could at the end of the day be worse than the disease. And I don't say that lightly.
Absolutely. And I think we're going to get into that a little deeper here. You know, and one thing that I just want to flush through a little more is, I think the problem with this virus is that it's going to impact people that otherwise were healthy and could shock people into a problematic situation that were otherwise healthy. And I'm not going to, I don't know how to word this without being offensive or insensitive or whatnot. I mean, obviously people that have cardiac arrest or cancer, I mean, they didn't deserve it. So I don't want to phrase it that way, but you know, it's a lot of this stuff develops over many, many years. This happens at the end of people's life or bad habits or naturally, you know, that's what people die of when they're very old or whatnot. This is something that someone can get and kill people potentially next week. So I think that's also the nuance of this as well. So maybe some comments addressing that.
Well, it's insidious in its ability to spread and to somehow remain alive on surfaces and such. And, you know, again, I don't want to make light of this. And at this point, we're all still relatively in the dark, which is one of the factors that makes us wonder about such a dramatic lockdown solution. Okay. But I will tell you, in my own family, my sister had a beautiful little girl, 8 years old, that came here and visited us in Bonita Springs. And she was having coordination difficulties. 2-3 weeks later, she was dead of a brain tumor. They thought that she was growing so fast that and that was, you know, her coordination couldn't keep up with her growth. Or in Switzerland, where I lived for a long time, a beautiful little girl in a village all of a sudden got a lung disease. This is about 3-4 years ago. Within 3 weeks, she was dead. Why do I say this? Not to belittle anything or any potential loss, but just to say, even a healthier segment of the population, a younger segment of the population, is vulnerable to extreme events or insidious diseases. And thus, us also finding this unfortunate incident here with the coronavirus hitting and even killing young people, I think needs to be put in a bit of context. But again, I'm speaking as a layman, and I'm trying to figure out as well as I can, to what extent Do we need to all take the precautions we do without killing the economic goose that lays the golden egg and threatens to push us into a full-blown depression, where our ability to ward off against this disease, to sustain ourselves, to keep civil liberty, and actually not to starve at the end of the day, are also something that needs to be thrown into the calculus.
Absolutely. Well, and we'll see how this ultimately flushes out. I mean, we, you know, this is the John Hopkins site, you know, at the time of this interview, 190,740. I'm going to try to get this interview out as soon as possible, probably by tomorrow. So you'll see the difference. 190,740 total confirmed cases here in the U.S. and 4,127 deaths. And so in a couple weeks, they're expecting 100 to 200,000 deaths. So let's see how that ultimately plays out statistically. Dan, we, and you alluded to this, we are in an economic grind, and we're in a bit of a war, and you articulated it in a way that I hadn't heard. Now, for me, the feeling of these two Mercy-class ships, these hospital naval ships on L.A., in an L.A. port and New York port, servicing our country, it feels like a homegrown war. You know, it feels like a war we're fighting on our own soil. Very eerie, I think, for a lot of us as Americans who, you know, we've always had this idea of war that's always somewhere else, but we're experiencing that here in our own country at the moment. And it's a hyper deflationary environment where people went from the greatest economy in quotes to this on a turn of a dime. People are hoarding cash. People are getting laid off in masses and droves, you know, a huge unemployment number. Initially, I mean, this is, and it just happened. I mean, we were in February booming, and here we are, end of March, first day of April. Things are massively different so quickly, so fast. Let's get your thoughts on this monetary, this economic war that we're dealing with.
Well, despite the President Trump's claim on the best economy ever, I think we had the biggest bubble ever. I think we've been sustaining a bubble economy where, in essence, we haven't respected the wealth of nations ideas that made the economy strong and great in the first place. I'm talking about sound property right protections. I'm talking about sanity in regulatory and litigation arenas. We're, in essence, getting it to a point where our weaknesses that we've accumulated thanks to misallocations, thanks to money printing, thanks to artificially low interest rates, and the bubbles that this has brought with us, both in bonds and stocks, is the soft underpinning. I would say that in fact, the economy, if it had truly been strong and we generated trade surpluses, and we had $1 trillion surplus instead of deficit in the strongest economy ever, then we would be better able to handle this. So I have a different take on how strong the economy was. I think the bubble was bigger than ever, but I don't think the underpinnings truly were there to support a hit below the belt line, if you will. And I think that's part of this issue we talked about before the interview, the pin that pricks the bubble. Well, if you have a bubble economy, then it gets pricked. If you have a sound economy in terms of surpluses and strong job growth in high value-added businesses and export surpluses that are huge deficits, then I would argue you're going to be better able to deal with this, and especially also if you have substantially lower debt encumbering everything. And the fear about counterparty risks. Are people good for the money? The whole issues where you have to rely on a printing press going into the direction of infinity to solve issues, I think that brings us even deeper into the mud eventually, at least economically and financially.
Dan, let me remind people of what February 2020 looked like. Tesla was, what, $917 per share. I mean, just that stock alone was the sum of four GM, Fiat, Chrysler, plus annual global silver production, the value of Tesla. The FANG stocks were on a tear. And in this environment, we are seeing things that are drastically different. You know, the bubble bursting. And so we are seeing trillions of dollars get thrown at the markets, helping people pay their rents and helping businesses kind of inch along here as the U.S. economy is shut down. This nationwide bailout happening, the most expensive economic response that we've ever seen in the history of the country. So my question is, just like we saw in 2008, where, we saw this massive amount of liquidity enter the markets and then be reflected in real estate, reflected in stocks, in the asset classes, are we going to see that go back into the financial assets, like reflate the stock market, in dollar terms, reflate the real estate market in dollar terms? And we really haven't seen the real estate market crash yet. And I'm not sure if you think that's going to happen or not, but what are your thoughts on this? This reflation of all this cash that's getting thrown at the markets at the moment.
I don't think it's going to work, is the short answer. The reasons for it are as follows. First of all, when you reflate a bubble, and at the same time you no longer have corporate treasurers buying record amounts of stock, as you probably know, in the last decade or so, the biggest purchaser of stocks were corporations themselves to goose the value of their stock options. So you're going to have that fall down. You're also going to have people that bought on debt. We had record margin debt until recently. Now you get margin calls. So some of the strongest peripheral buyers and the main buyer, bigger than any other of stocks, namely corporate treasuries, the treasurer at GE and Boeing are probably a bit infamous in this regard. Those are going to now go in reverse. So you're not going to have this demand. We've also obviously, in a bigger sense, have an aging society, which tends to liquefy stocks, especially since we have yield deprivation or starvation. People can't make ends meet. So you've got an aging society dynamic layered on top of this. But more to the point, I think people, you mentioned, they're hoarding cash. They're trying to keep ahead of pink slips. They're afraid they're going to be join the ranks of the unemployed. I mean, there's some estimates here that project a 30% unemployment rate, which is greater than in the Great Depression. I think what's going to happen is the money is going to go from the markets, also at some point from the bonds, which is the biggest bubble we have of all, into the real world, into goods. If that happens, and we also get dollar weakness because America, in essence, has promised to, in essence, torch its currency, we will print however much we want. Good, it's competing with other printing central banks, but those are typically central banks or companies that don't need huge $600 billion a year external financing. So I think the money is going to go from the bubbles. People always said, well, where's the inflation? Well, inflation, and if you take a look at John Williams' work and others, well, it isn't 2%, it's more like 8%. We've seen that perking up. If all of a sudden output and services and industry have a body blow, and we bring all this money to bear, and the Fed will do anything and everything. I mean, that the Fed has gotten from the Treasury Department $425 billion. That it can leverage 10-1 to bail out anything and everybody, violating its charter yet again. It wasn't supposed to monetize debt. It wasn't supposed to deal in hanky-panky in terms of granting loans to institutions that weren't government-backed. But all these things are going on, and what we've got is this massive creation of money at the monetary base that at some point, given scarcity through this lockdown, is going to find its way into the money supply. And that, especially if companies begin to hoard, if they can hoard, why? Because they're no longer, this global supply chain is broken. So what you've got is you've got to change the people wanting to put that money into real assets, companies into inventory, people into toilet paper and water and so forth. So if you continue to increase the money supply, that is, the multiplier starts to reflect all these fears that, in contrast to what you said, we might even go into an inflationary world because money base and supply is going up while the amount of goods and services are being killed or given a huge haircut through this lockdown. We might end up in a Venezuelan kind of scenario where we have strongly depressed output, shrinking output, a depression accompanied by hyperinflation. I personally believe that that's what's going to happen, and we have a deflation. I think the Fed and everybody else is going to fight it tooth and nail, and they're going to get what they want, but then it will get out of control. But that's the big debate. Are we going into deflation, the deflationary recession or depression, or is it going to be a stagflation variety of it? I personally am more in the latter camp because central banks of the world have told us they will do anything and everything to debase their currencies.
Yes, Dan, that's very true. And one of the things that I've been asking my guests, and it's a nuanced question, multifaceted, but in this environment where people are having trouble paying their rent, people are having trouble paying their mortgages, this is true on the commercial side as well as personal, there's a lot of debt that is not going to get serviced in this environment. I mean, we know the Russell 2000, many of the companies haven't reported earnings. Can we anticipate what this crash is going to begin to look like? Is there going to be a massive transfer of ownership, or is the government going to be able to paper this over to a certain degree by bailouts for people on a personal level, businesses, and, you know, multi-billion dollar corporations?
Good question. I think we're going to have TARP on steroids. I think we're going to have more nationalization of the financial sector. We're going to move, this might be an ugly term, more strongly in the direction of fascism, where the state and industry are more strongly intertwined. I'm speaking mainly of the big companies. You know, the consolidation of the media under Clinton to six, we have profits, monopoly profits growing. We have K Street and Wall Street typically being the initial beneficiaries together with the bureaucrats that they work with and change hats with. So I have the sense that in effect, we're moving more towards nationalization, further away from sound money, federalism, small government. And this, in my opinion, is a recipe over time for anything but a constructive, low inflationary growth world. But we have to first deal with what's at hand. And your question is a salient one. What good does all this theory do if we're all going to go broke first, right? So give me a break already. I agree. But then the question is what can we do that's sensible to reverse the lockdown where it does make sense to get the economy up and running? Because look, if you have a $22 trillion economy, you can bail out with fake money, you know, for $2 trillion. Actually, it's closer to $6 trillion if the money that the Fed is going to get is the $425 billion is leveraged 10 to 1, which it will be. But these bailouts all pale in comparison to shutting down the economy. I mean, you know, if you shut it down for a quarter, the whole thing, that's a quarter of $22 trillion. Mm. And part of that is not going to come back. You're going to face restaurants that can't get back on their feet. You're going to find airlines and other entities which have abused the share repurchase thing, right, and are now in a lot of trouble. I guess my answer is the best possible solution from my perspective is to reduce lockdowns where sensible is the more data we have to try to get the economy back up and running and to have the to be the motor that pays the bills and allows people to stay employed.
You know, there's been a lot of reflection. I mean, this has been very emotional for me. just experiencing, you know, what it's like to just be in a lockdown scenario, you know, the government telling you, you can't go anywhere, you can't be free, and everything shut down. The whole world is in this together, which is kind of oddly binding, but just a very strange dream at the same time. And we're seeing the differences between essential business versus non-essential business. And, you know, for the person who has a quote unquote non-essential business, of course, that's not non-essential to them. It's very essential for them and their livelihood. But, you know, we're seeing what is truly needed to keep the economy going, you know, as far as what people need for survival. They need food, they need water, they need certain things to keep their house going, the hospitals. And, you know, it's very real understanding of basic needs. So many of us are just dependent on internet and our phones and some things like that. But then when it all boils down, you know, somebody on my Twitter yesterday pointed something out. It's like, it's interesting how all the degrees are home right now and all the trades are out keeping the world running, yes. Which I thought was kind of a, you know, humorous, yeah. and eye-opening at the same time, but along the lines of, you know, essential versus non-essential, people wanting food. They want fresh food, you know, but they're afraid to go to the grocery store and get infected, you know, and yeah, you might have a stockpile of granola bars and dried foods and pastas and whatnot, but you know, you want bananas and apples and celery and spinach and milk and eggs and chicken and whatnot. I mean, all these different things that you can't just store for months on end. So Dan, I mean, talk to us about, you know, essential versus non-essential economies. I mean, what do you see lasting through this, and what gets the axe as we go through this?
Great question. You know, I was going to find before our interview, but I ran out of time, the site that I think the label is this, What It Takes to Make a Pencil. And here is the deal. And I want to contrast this to central planners and bureaucrats that determine what are essential and non-essential services. If memory serves, that video, What It Takes to Make a Pencil, involved something like 1,500 different suppliers, resources shipped in from all over the world. What's my bigger point? If bureaucrats plan here, like they plan our money and the disaster that fiat money has been ever since Nixon took America off the gold standard, compared to how America fared when it had sound money and federalism and low income taxes, the response of the patient is just like a young, healthy buck. You can spring back, you have less baggage, you have less chronic issues. I'm very sober, or I think it's sobering indeed, when bureaucrats like the governor of New York and governor of California determine what are essential and unessential businesses, because I don't think they have a clue. Only the market does, and nobody can figure out where. Well, look, I'll make an example. Let's say you have an important component part with a ventilator missing, right? If you don't have that part, you can't source it. You might only be missing one part, but you're not going to be able to ship the desperately needed ventilator. And this is a story writ large across the landscape of when you shut down by fiat, industries or sectors or determined businesses are non-essential, when in fact you don't really even know the entire supplier involvement and the geographic diversity and who all plays a small part to making that thing actually viable. You might only be missing one or two parts, and because you've determined someone to be non-essential, that part is missing. You notice Trump recently dropped all the trade, trade. He had the trade thing going on with China, and he put up what the 20-30% tariffs, the word I'm looking for. The other day, quietly in the middle of the night, they were all dropped to zero. And I think that is in essence a shot across the bow of having to loosen things back up. That's good stuff. That's common sense. we take care of those people that are vulnerable, like we do in any flu season. And I'm not trying to minimize this, but we open back up an economy. Bureaucrats, whether they're central bankers or other bureaucrats, are terrible planners, and we get less prosperity and less freedom and less choice. And we need choice. We need to be able to get these things. We have to incentivize production and not hit people for being able to charge a higher price for scarcity, because that higher price is what's going to bring an avalanche of new producers. And you better hope they're not in the non-essential category. Does that make any sense?
You know, I want to ask you, Dan, about the power play situation. You alluded to it. What is being implemented now that might be irreversible? Now, it's nuanced. I will admit that I am in full compliance with social distancing. I have no problem, you know, coming together as a society and saying, hey, let's try not to touch each other and put some practices in place. But I am fully aware of the concern of having a powerful government being implemented and coming into our lives in a way that is irreversible, overpowering, overbearing. And I'm just curious what your thoughts are on this in this crisis. You mentioned something in the pre-interview here, never let a good crisis go to waste. What does that mean to you?
Well, think back to the Patriot Act and the 9/11 debacle, right? However people consider how that took place, what happened, the point is Americans had to surrender a lot of their liberty for safety. Senator Rand Paul couldn't travel. All kinds of things happened. My grandfather, a World War II vet that fought in Okinawa, was frisked up at Albany Airport. And I told him, if you take his belt off, the pants are going to land on the floor. What's my bigger point? Every time we have a crisis, and clearly this is a crisis, but we've had other crises before. If you end up locking down the place and all of a sudden, in essence, eviscerating the Constitution, the Bill of Rights protections, federalism, not to speak of sound money, right? That's why it was put in. Then what you have is a progressively higher state of statism. You know, it's the analogy with a frog that's sitting in a pot. And if you start heating the water slowly enough, he doesn't realize by the time it's boiling, it's too late and he's dead. And again, I'm not trying to make light of this, but I'm afraid that we will again as a society, not constructively, but counter-constructively, choose safety and possibly be pushed into behavior or acceptance of an expanded state that are not going to be good either for economic growth or for freedom. Governor Hogan in Maryland, as an example, I've got a good buddy that lives in Annapolis. I mean, he issued, and this is a Republican governor, good, he's a rhino, they issued a long list of things that residents of Maryland or Marylanders can't do. And I said to him, well, what happens if you do one of those things? And my buddy said, you get an immediate $5,000 fine. Let me bring it closer to Bonita Springs, Florida, where I'm talking to you from. Here, people, thankfully, are allowed to go to Walmart. They're allowed to go to drugstores. But you know what? All the beaches are closed. Now, people that go on beaches here have great distance, typically. No one is too terribly close. Not any more than a family would be close in a house. They might be together on a beach. But strangers have large distance between them. Now I ask you, what is the sense behind such a closure while at the same time you can meet at Walmarts where people bump into each other at the checkout line, literally, even today? So I am leery because I'm a constitutionalist, a federalist. The Austrian School of Economics, I'm leery about giving government any chance to ratchet up its power beyond the Constitution. And that very much includes the state level today. I mean, the governor of California, the governor of New York, I think they are possibly not going to be so ready and willing together with their army of bureaucrats to relinquish some of the powers and some of the restrictions they are now imposing. That is what happens over time. That's what we saw after the Patriot Act. And that is not good either for freedom or economic growth or prosperity. Might sound like, you know, a non-essential issue, or let's talk about that after we've solved this. But again, if this happens to go too far, then we might never regain, or we'll have even less fidelity to what's left of the tattered Constitution. And I think that is a concern that can be shielded. How many bureaucrats have been told to go home? Do you know that in the $2.2 trillion bailout bill, the budget for the bureaucracy is up by $350 billion? How many Congress people have to go home or face the same things the rest of us? In other words, just like Obamacare, they didn't have to eat the cooking that the rest of us did. And I'm just naturally leery. I'm not a conspiracy theory guy, but I fear that this can get out of control. And thus the Emmanuel, what's his name up in Chicago, the mayor of Chicago, he said, never let a good crisis go to waste. Translation, if there is a crisis, use it to expand the power of government in an unconstitutional manner.
Dan, what is the fallout going to be when it comes to precious metals in this environment? We have gold right at $1,600 at the moment, the spot price of gold. Now, you're lucky to get an American Eagle under $1,800 right now. Silver, similar situation, $14 for the spot price. But again, you know, good luck getting it under $20 an ounce if you can find it. So what are your thoughts on gold and silver? Are they holding up to your expectations in this environment? Or put differently, do you expect more from them here in the immediate future?
Could I frame that with the stock market?
Absolutely. Okay?
I have put out posts in the past, and this is what I want to highlight here. Let's say you have just a 2-3% decline in GDP, right? The sales line of companies, the S&P 500 is about 60-70% of total economic output or GDP. If they get whacked along the same lines as the economy, because they are the economy, then the bottom line residual with a relatively modest single digit top line reduction get absolutely whacked. From 06 to 08 to 09, earnings, including Big Bath Accounting, dropped by 90%. And they took 6 years to get back up to the 06 level. This time around, we're going to go through that with much more baggage, much more debt, much more misallocations, more cronyism, more redistributionism. This is going to make, and less of a focus on economic growth, financial engineering over real engineering. I want to contrast the 08-09 market downdraft where the S&P fell 50% or more, earnings fell 80% and took 6 years to recover with today. In the 08-09 period, silver and gold got hit. Why? Because as you know, people get margin calls. They sell what's liquid, what they can to meet commitments, to generate income, and so on and so on. But shortly thereafter, 2-3 months into that stock market crash, precious metals parted ways with the stock market, and they had a multi-year sharp upwards trajectory. I expect the same thing this time around, but in an even more convincing fashion. That is, I think the outperformance of precious metals relative to the stock market and soon enough relative to the bond market are going to be even more substantial. Not only because less than 0.5% of the world's investable assets are positioned, but because this time our EPS hole, which is what makes even today's S&P valuation at 18 to 19 times 12-month moving gap earnings so vulnerable, this time around, we're likely not only to ape the last earnings compression, but we're likely to exceed it. And everybody keeps talking about, is it a V-shaped, a U-shaped, or an L-shaped recovery? Well, what if it's an L-shaped recovery with a horizontal line dragging downwards. In other words, we could be in the soup with earnings per share for a long time. The Fed, as you know, will sprinkle a lot of money into the equation to keep bubbles going. Pension funds depend on it, especially since there's no more yields. And in such an environment where you do very crass monetary debasement, and at the same time you have less supply available, I think precious metals are going to reflect that and more. Specifically, we've got a very profound long-term monetary inflation risk. I think it's not that long-term. And we have an insolvency risk. So whether you get a haircut in bonds or companies go out of business as a shareholder, we're much more exposed because our situation is much more dire than it was back in 08. We doubled down on all the things that we should have moved away from. We have more debt, more money printing, more misallocations, more cronyism, and I don't say that lightly. But as a result, precious metals, also priced in gold relative to the S&P 500, whether gold or silver, they've been in a long-term bull market, as I'm sure you're aware. I mean, you can buy the Dow, for example, with roughly 13 ounces of gold. The dot-com bubble before it popped, it took like 40. But in the early 80s and in the early 30s, we went down to a one-to-one relationship to the Dow. And you can, by extension, include the S&P in a big way. I think we're going in that direction because I believe that stocks are going to be under pressure that is going to be long-standing from two fronts. Because it's going to be tough to get the earnings back up and running. It took 6 years from 06 to get higher earnings in 11, just barely, and we were much less screwed up. So you've got earnings that are going to take a hit, 50, 60%, and we're probably going to stay down for the count. And I think we're going to face higher interest rates because bondholders and bond vigilantes are going to reflect upon the fact that the central banks are going to print their currency and the bonds that are in that currency into oblivion. That's their goal. That's what they tell you. That's what they show us. And on the other hand, you also have heightened insolvency issues at various levels because of all the debt. And these are the things that I think are going to keep stock and soon bond valuations at a much lower level, meaning PEs much lower, bond yields much higher. Stocks and bonds over time travel together. If you look at earnings yield and you compare them with bond yields, earnings yield is a PE flip, but they travel. Yardini and Co. does excellent work on this. They travel together, superimpose upon that the fact that in times of strong duress, gold has typically bought a Dow share, and we're still at 13, and we're heading into an even worse situation due to this horrific virus, then I think you're going to see tremendous outperformance of both stocks and soon bonds in gold and silver. Now, whether that is gold that gets to 10,000 and a Dow is 10,000, or whether gold goes from 1,600 and they pump up so much money that the Dow goes to 40,000 because it's inflationary, I don't know. But in any case, if you compare it to the current value of gold, whether you get 10,000 Dow, 10,000 gold, or get a 40,000 Dow, thanks to huge inflation, and a $40,000 price of gold, the increase in the gold price is going to be a lot more substantial than the stocks.
Powerful. Dan, you know, I know you mentioned those numbers there, $10,000 gold, $40,000 gold, depending on what the Fed does. I know those were somewhat anecdotal, but my question to you then was not necessarily a price prediction, but what would you expect? What would be just even like a very reasonable expectation from gold going forward here over the next, 12 months as we're having such an extreme reaction at the moment, I expect a reaction in precious metals sooner rather than later. Mm-hmm.
Good question. Let's stop with the way out there stuff. And I don't even think that's way out there. I mean, look, I mentioned 10,000 Dow. You know, we fell from 30,000 to 20,000 in 2 weeks, you know. And given an earnings compression that's going to be, we're going to go from the positive EPS numbers, $139 per share on the S&P, to probably half that or less and stay down. So these are numbers which are not, it's all very compressed is what I'm trying to say. And this lockdown is going to compress it even further and cause things to happen more quickly. In terms of how this could evolve in precious metals prices, as you noted, we have spot prices, futures based, or we have physical metals prices. And you mentioned that there is a divergence, that is the premium between spot, which they can more easily manipulate, and actual physical metal is widening. So first of all, the question is, what's the true price of gold and silver? Is it the physical price or is it the spot price? I would argue to you, if you're trying to get out of debt-based instruments at risk, insolvency risk, inflation risk, then you're not going to settle for paper gold or paper silver. You're going to want the real deal, and you're going to want it nearby, just in case, right? And as far as what kind of price could they have in 6 months from now? Well, if we continue printing like crazy and we get the second stimulus package and the initial wave of gold and silver sales, mostly gold because there's hardly any silver out there in invested positions, certainly not in investable assets managed globally to the tune of 200 trillion, according to Credit Suisse. But if we're in a situation where all of a sudden people like in 08, 09 have thrown what they could at the market, the weak hands have turned in their gold to stuff the holds, to meet the margin calls, to meet expenses. After that's done, in the midst of a continued fragmentation of our economy, thanks to sustained lockdowns and this thing feeding on itself, I think you're going to have a sharp turn. And I think gold and silver could easily be double, triple today's value within 6 to 12 months. And move down the line on the Dow ratio or the S&P 500 ratio, where instead of 13 ounces of gold, it might only take 7 or 8. And it'll be less relevant where the Dow is in terms of your actual purchasing power. Because what's going to be relevant is how much, in a way, of stocks or bonds or real estate will you be able to buy with the physical precious metals. But in terms of nominal gold and silver prices in dollar terms, which, as you know, thanks to a strong dollar, which is starting to crack, have lagged the rest of the world where gold has made new highs for a few years in other currencies. I think we're going to see a relatively rapid shift. And here's the primary reason. Beyond what I just said, if you have 200 trillion in global investable assets and the investment exposure in precious metals, essentially gold, is 0.5%. And these people at the margin decide this paper isn't any good anymore, or we're afraid of it being inflated away or insolvency. They make just a tiny move. That 200 billion goes from 0.5% to 1% exposure. That move would require roughly 10 years of gold and silver mining in order to fulfill. Translation, you're going to have a higher equilibrium price in order to bump up the value of gold, essentially gold to a lesser degree, silver compared to your other assets, which will come under pressure as stocks and bonds eventually crate. So it's the law of small numbers, if you will. It's the tiny amount of silver or gold allocation against the very small amount of mining and a lot of gold in very firm hands that I think is what the big driver is going to be to send these precious metals prices screaming higher. It doesn't take much. That's where I get the 2-3-fold increased number in a relatively short period of time.
Dan, I hope you don't mind me going a little longer than I normally do. I'm greatly enjoying this interview with you. I have one or two more questions for you. Normally my interviews go about 30 minutes, but my goodness, we're getting into some seriously interesting things and I haven't got through everything yet. So I want to ask you about silver specifically. Now, I did a quick calculation while you were responding there. The current gold silver ratio is 113. We saw it get to 125. It got real crazy, right? But if you actually go on and look at a bullion dealer and take, you know, the American Eagle with the premium and divide it by a gold American Eagle divided by a silver American Eagle, the silver to gold ratio, a gold silver ratio is 75. I mean, it's not really 113. It's that's the paper gold silver ratio. So gold silver ratio, but the actual physical is much lower than that. Let's talk about silver. Obviously, the spot price has been disappointing for many people. You have to acknowledge, though, that the industrial component of silver is getting crushed right now with the whole world going on economic lockdown. Is that going to be a long-term issue for silver that could keep it down for the long to midterm here?
Great point, Kenneth. Yes, silver, if you take a look at silver demand, it's about 60% industrial, right? And the rest is basically jewelry and such, probably the second biggest component, then investment demand, the third. I'm sure you're aware, based at least upon Silver Institute statistics, that for the last 10 or 11 years, the actual mined supply of silver has lagged the total demand for silver by roughly 20 to 25% per annum. In other words, the mines haven't kept up with demand. What's my point? As industrial demand craters thanks to the supply chain snafus that this global virus response has triggered, we're going to obviously buy less things that have silver in them. Some of them can't even be produced. People aren't going to buy a new cell phone if they need toilet paper. You know where I'm going with this. Sure, you're losing that. But at the same time, first of all, you only were able to supply 80% of the total demand before. Second, the supply side is also at risk, meaning silver mine shutdowns, such as in South America, where most of the silver of the world is mined, are also coming into place. So you have a reduction not only in the demand, or the 60% component of it, but you also have a reduction in supply that's coming, and that supply only constituted 80% of demand for over 11 years. So there's a give and a take, and it's difficult to know exactly where this will come down. It suggests that you're going to have net pressure from reduced industrial demand on the silver price. But let me get back for just one second to what I said before. If investors, that is professional investors, I mentioned Credit Suisse, where I used to work in the CIO office as thematic strategist. If they determine that they also don't trust their own paper markets, okay, and they decide that they want to get some silver because it's 75 to 1 to gold, right? 75 ounces of gold in a physical market to 1 ounce of gold, then it would only take a tiny allocation into physical silver. They're going to be buying a 1,000 ounce bar, for, and don't forget, 200 trillion, a 1% reallocation is $2 trillion, right? The silver mining output is 13 billion a year. Above ground supply readily available is something like 2 billion ounces. The kind of numbers that they would throw at this to invest in silver, if that's what they actually do. In addition to, you know, silver is like the Camaro, the poor man's Corvette. It's the money of the masses. But what happens if the fat cats, the people that run all the money, decide they want to dip their toe in the water with 200 trillion in net assets or stocks and bonds, mostly bonds under allocation? It will overrun any reduced industrial demand. That's my point. And in fact, you're already seeing that at the street level with small purchases from dealers today, aren't we? So if in fact institutional demand, professional money managers decide that they actually want to incur the expense of having some physical silver, which they typically don't do because they can't earn a money management fee on it, right? That's why they want paper everything. You don't earn a money management fee by storing silver, physical silver for somebody. But if at the margin they jump in just a tiny amount, that dynamic will overshadow any kind of industrial slowdown in demand. That's what I think. And that's what's going to be reflected in the price. And in fact, as I said, we're already seeing that reflected in the price as us little people buy silver to protect ourselves against what might be something that gets totally out of control.
Dan, it was an absolute pleasure to speak with you. We will not wait this long to have another conversation. Maybe we'll do one in sooner rather than later, actually, another interview here. If people want to learn more about you, your work, please let them know where they can go and what they can expect to find, you know, at your website, your YouTube videos, and the things that you're producing.
Thank you very much, Kenneth. It was my pleasure, and I greatly appreciate the opportunity to chat with you. The website is dkanalytics.com. There are posts and videos. Those are the two main areas that people can have a look at. The videos are at YouTube, but they're also embedded onto the website. You'll see a very clear place to go and click on that, and that'll get you into the video section and the post section. Click on that and anything that I've posted, including a recent article on silver that was republished by Schiff Gold and some other people in the industry that might interest people that want to take a closer look at silver.
Dan, and if you would, maybe just share some closing thoughts here. I never gave you that opportunity. I normally do for my audience. Just some closing thoughts as we close out this interview.
I think we risk running into a gathering recession morphing into a depression. I'm concerned that the response by the policymakers and those in charge won't only be beneficial in terms of arresting the rate of virus infections. In other words, I think their cure might be worse than the disease. And I don't want to make light of any deaths. Don't get me wrong. I want to repeat that. But as such, the world economic, financial, and political order, I think, could come apart at the seams if we morph into a full-fledged depression. People at the Fed are talking about 30% unemployment, right? If we get into this environment and if we don't open things back up in a sensible manner quickly enough, we might be going there. And what that means for stock and later bond valuations and precious metals valuations couldn't be more clear in my view. In short, stocks will remain under tremendous pressures if the earnings residual is 25-30% of the $139 that the S&P index earned, GAAP EPS, and bonds at some point will see a stagflationary environment where central bankers are going to do anything in their power to, in essence, debase the currency. If those two things come together, we have even more pressure on our ability to carry debt, which will be responded with even more money printing, and that is going to be reflected in precious metals prices. That will be your passport, I believe, to purchasing stocks and bonds in the future that are in single-digit PEs for stocks and back to possibly even double-digit earnings yields. I'm sorry, dividend yields in one more time. You will not only see single-digit PEs, I think that's very possible, but you will see bonds again in high single-digit or low double-digit yield territory, perhaps higher. And that's when you turn in your gold and silver chips. But that could well be a ways down the road. Remember, we stayed in the stagflationary 70s for a decade, and the stock market, the S&P or the Dow, was in trading range for 13 years. So what's coming up might be a very difficult quagmire to get out of. And we're going to hopefully have wonderful opportunities to purchase blue chip stocks that again yield 6, 7, 8% instead of 2%. And the ticket to the passport to getting there is cash, good cash, no risk in terms of having a long bond kind of interest rate risk, and obviously precious metals. If you're going to hold cash, hold treasury bills. Don't enter a duration risk. If you're going to hold cash, be careful in terms of bail-in and bailout risks. These are all things we follow. And in that sense, buckle down and get ready for what might be a very difficult and protracted struggle where hopefully we come out stronger instead of weaker.